X Squared Radio.
The spice extends life.
This is where the past meets the future.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Where we explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are traveling across the frozen desert tonight or working at your favorite workstation, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Recline your chair, look out the window, as we are about to launch X Squared Radio, January 29th, 2012. Welcome to the program. Glad you're tuning in to get squared. Lots going on. Tonight, in our second hour, we have Holly Evelyn, author of Red Goddess Rising. You don't want to miss it. It's a great book. You're wondering what the mysteries are in Egypt, Bali, Bhutan, India. Pay no attention to that phone ringing in the background. That's a sound effect. Holly Evelyn, second hour, 6 p.m. Pacific time. The solar wind today is a howling 412 kilometers per second. Accelerated by Friday's X flare, energetic protons from the sun are still swarming around Earth tonight. You might be feeling it. The radiation storm ranks an S2 on NOAA scales, which means it is not a severe storm. Nevertheless, it can still affect spacecraft and satellites at the nuisance level. So be careful if you are leaving the planet tonight. Make sure to have your radiation shields working and have a safe journey. By the way, bring us back something, will you? When the sun goes down tonight, step outside and look up. Jupiter and the nearly half moon are gathering together less than 10 degrees apart in the sky. It's a beautiful sight and a nice way to end the day, end the week. Begin the week however you want to punctuate your life. We have again dodged a cosmic bullet. A powerful X-class flare blasted away from the sun today, but from a sunspot near to the western limb. The double barrel missed Earth again. And by the way, there are reports that satellites have landed in Ohio. It's true, but it's not what you think. They came on a truck. A trio of once-secret U.S. spy satellites built to look down on the Soviet Union were unveiled in Ohio on Thursday in a rare public display by the United States Air Force. The vintage reconnaissance satellites joined the Cold War Gallery at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force in Dayton, Ohio, and will eventually be installed in a new wing for the space relics and other aircraft. The satellites, called KH-7 Gambit 1, the KH-8 Gambit 3, and the KH-9 Hexagon, were officially declassified in September after having all the secret stuff taken out by the National Reconnaissance Office and released for public viewing from a distance behind the rope. No touching, please. Last year, the NRO celebrated its 50th anniversary, and we announced the declassification of two NRO systems, Gambit and Hexagon, which were America's eyes in the space and most sophisticated in satellites of their time. NRO Director Air Force General retired, Bruce Carlson said in a statement. He goes on to say these systems were critical for monitoring key targets in the USSR and around the globe, and provided much-needed cartographic information, along with other stuff, to the DOD to produce accurate, large-scale maps. By the way, governments are not the only ones making ventures into space. It's true. A Canadian two-man team of young scientists launched the world's first Lego astronaut into space and retrieved him alive. Two Canadian high schoolers have wowed the web with their video of a Lego toy making a balloon ride to near space. The video, made by Toronto 17-year-olds Matthew Ho and Asad Muhammad, shows a tiny Lego man holding a Canadian flag with the blue curve of the Earth far below and the black of space above. It is the latest example of do-it-yourself near-space photography by an amateur balloon-launching team. The teens used a weather balloon to carry the Lego minifigure and set of cameras, one with a fisheye lens, into the stratosphere, ultimately reaching a height of nearly 80,000 feet before the balloon burst, according to the Toronto Star. Once the balloon popped, the Lego man and his attached cameras fell back to Earth, screaming all the way under a homemade parachute. Homeland Security folks have put them on a no space list, so I'm afraid these two young men will never become U.S. manned space participants. Oh, yeah, I guess no American will be going to space until we change presidents. By the way, I heard an old argument today from somebody that I like. I mean, a friend of mine. Really old argument. One of my business partners said, Gingrich, Newt, has a stupid idea of wasting taxpayer dollars to make a base on the moon. Right now, there are 69 active space programs, Earth explorers. Whereas many of them are exciting, they reach far out into space beyond anything practical for our planet. Oh, yeah, they're searching for Earth-like planets around stars 25,000 light years away. With the exception of the trillions of dollars in military defense programs, there is nothing that is aimed at utilizing the moon. It is my opinion that a moon colony would not only be profitable in so many ways we couldn't count them, it would be smart to have a land-based space station a mere 3 days away from Earth. There's fuel, water, and the availability of many large subsurface access points that would make for a natural shield against solar or galactic radiation. No-brainer, folks. One thing is for sure. If the U.S. doesn't return to the moon, China will. I've always said, he who controls the moon controls Earth, ancient Chinese proverb. Okay, well, maybe it's just me and a few thousand of my friends who say it, but I still believe it. By the way, if you're planning your 2012 activities, and I highly recommend that you do, you know, January has already blown by us, all right? It's the 29th today. 2 days ago, it was New Year's Day. So this year has already officially been shortened to only a few months. So you need to get your planning done now, because you're getting ready to get your W-2s or your 1099s or whatever it is, however it is you reveal your most private secrets to the government on whatever various government forms each year before April 15th. Somewhere in there, most of you loaned money interest-free to the government for an entire year. Why? I have no idea. But you're about to get a refund check sometime in the next 90 days. Don't blow it, people. I'm urging you. I'm imploring you. Go to Maya 2012, the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com. Check it out. Just click on it and explore it, because you could be with me in the Yucatan at Chichen Itza from the 13th of December to the 22nd of December. I promise to have you home by Christmas, and you will have stories to tell your family that no family for the last 26,000 years has heard. You were at ground zero when the Mayan calendar was reset. And you were at ground zero at Chichen Itza for Maya 2012. Join me, Greg Braden, other world-class speakers there. And at the same venue, Sting and Carlos Santana. Come on, it doesn't get any better than that. It's affordable. We're all leaving out of Houston. Make your way there. Join us there. We fly down there. We'll have 10 days of awesomeness. And then you can return. And there's no workshop, I promise. No. It will be a life change. Set it up now. Maya 2012. Orange Banner. xsquaredradio.com. Don't forget. In case you don't have a passport and you don't want one, or you don't want to go south during that period of time or take that much time off, I have an option for you. That's right. Nope, nope. You weren't getting away from me that easily. Because a couple of months before that, in October, there is the Pythagoras Conference. Now, here's what you're going to like about the Pythagoras Conference. It's in the Midwest. It's right smack dab in the middle of 73% of the population of the United States. You can drive there. You don't have to fly to the West Coast. You don't have to go join the New Agers out there at Shasta or L.A. This is going to be just north of Louisville at a wonderful casino resort in southern Indiana. To find out, and by the way, if you click now, you get $100 off. It doesn't get any better than this. Almost 50 speakers at this event. It's in the Midwest. You can drive there, save the price of airfare. It's affordable, and I just gave you $100 off. You click on the blue banner that says Pythagoras Conference at xsquaredradio.com. Now, you have all the conferences that you need to attend for the year already mapped out. You see how easy that is? And I got you the information before you got paid back your loan, your interest-free loan to the federal government. It's awesome. I know. You guys love it. Yes, it's great. It's great. You're going to enjoy it. You're going to have an awesome time. You're going to hear great music, meet great people, hear wonderful speakers, and you're going to be at ground zero. Awesome. All right, lots going on in the news today. One of the things that kind of awakens me, it kind of lets me know, we live in a pretty precarious time. This week, joint military training exercises will be held evenings in downtown Los Angeles through Thursday. By the way, if I have any listeners in the Los Angeles area, if you've seen any of these military activities go on, there are helicopters, land-based vehicles, all kinds of rapid response teams, radio teams. Now, these are just exercises. They're just running around the city streets, and they're practicing. They're practicing. But if you're seeing it go on, I would really appreciate a phone call. My toll-free number is 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Anywhere in North America. If you are on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us. 530-413-6472. And I've got one other number just in case you plan on heading out of the house or you want to be cleaning tonight to get ready for the week or whatever. You can also listen by your cell phone. All you have to do is call 760-569-7676. That's 760-569-7676. And then dial the access code 534-355-POUND. 534-355-POUND. If you do that, then you can listen to the entire program via Bluetooth. And you won't be able to interact, but you can listen to the whole program. I encourage you to interact because we have some interesting stuff. Anyway, if you're in the Los Angeles area and you see these operations going on, I'd really appreciate a phone call because I'd like to just know what's going on. The LAPD will be providing support for the exercises, which will also be held in other portions of the greater Los Angeles area. If you're not from LA, I just got to tell you, there's a greater Los Angeles area that will blow your mind. LA is just LA. But then there's Santa Monica, and there's La Cañada, and there's Granada Hills, and the Simi Valley, and it goes on and on and on. It's like a concrete jungle. So these operations are going on all over the place. Now, training sites have been carefully selected to ensure the event does not negatively impact the citizens of Los Angeles and their daily routine, a department official said. The training, which a department official said would involve helicopters, has been coordinated with local authorities and owners of the training sites, police said. Police and safety precautions have been taken to prevent risk to the general public and military personnel involved. The exercises are closed to the public, police said. No press. But, you know, take a cell phone picture, email it to me. I'm cool with it. The exercises are designed to ensure the military's ability to operate in urban environments, prepare forces for upcoming overseas deployments, and meet mandatory training certification requirements, police said. Now, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist. Okay, maybe it does take a rocket scientist, but you have one right here on this program tonight to figure out that Los Angeles isn't really a good model for urban preparations in foreign countries on account of the roads are paved and there are traffic lights and, you know, stuff like that. But there are lots of cities in the United States that have all this stuff. And as luck would have it, in the same year, in the same country, there are going to be two conventions. One, we already know, is going to be in the lovely downtown area of Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, it would raise some eyebrows, I think more than that, if the military were to come to Charlotte and practice their maneuvers. And so they're not. They're all the way over on the other side of the country, and they're practicing. They're practicing communication, working with high-rises, working with freeways, figuring out how to reroute traffic, working with local law enforcement, blah, blah, blah. The re-coronation of our current monarch is going to be taking place in the Queen's City. And no surprises. No surprises. So in my opinion, this training is being done for a bigger purpose. By the way, I want to let you know, not that we're any kind of conspiracy theorists here. We don't get rattled by anything. Occasionally we have technical problems here. Usually it's because I press the wrong button or I'm not really prepared. Occasionally it has to do with some wild animal running through the studio in California. But we have a greater problem tonight, and it may plague us. We just don't know. It has a couple of times in the last few days. It appears that some nefarious group out there, even though BBS Radio Network is the largest webcast radio network on the web, and X Squared Radio is the number one program on the BBS Radio Network, and we mind our own business here, eating cookies and drinking milk, no profanity. We've been targeted. I know it's messy stuff, this liberty. But we're okay with it. If you're okay with it, if they take us out tonight, we have patch cords everywhere, and we can figure out how to work around it, I promise. So if you're listening live, you know, pay close attention. If you're listening to the archive, I promise we're not going to cut out any of the nefariousness. You'll be entertained just as well. We find it entertaining, too, because, you know, on the BBS Radio Network, we don't have a lot of Alex Jones-type programs here. Mostly it's New Age and healing and good time feeling stuff. And here at X Squared Radio, we only do exploration into the mysteries of the universe and the earth. And we don't really hurt anybody's feelings. If you've had your feelings hurt on this program, I'm sorry. My heartfelt apologies. If you want to be heard on a regular basis, you can listen to Neil Bortz or one of the other programs. We don't do that here. So feel free to call in. You know, we're all friends, and it's just between you and me. And, well, you know, a few million listeners, but we'll make you feel at home. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Feel free to call me. Also, you know, we've had a lot of very interesting debates. I think they're entertaining. I felt that... Oh, yeah, by the way, I want to let you know that if we go down, if they actually hit us tonight, we do have a backup plan. We do. Get out a piece of chalk or a dry erase or a manual word processor of some kind. And remember that if we get wiped out tonight and you're listening live, you can switch over to bbstalkradio.com and just /streams, plural, /start, /BBS Radio 2. That's our patch. If it happens, just play this back tomorrow and you can get back to us. Sorry we can't put that on the website. It's too short a notice. But hopefully they're all sleeping. It's Sunday night. They'll leave us alone. Everything will be good. The GOP race could go on for a long time. Now, Democrats profess to be thrilled about this prospect. I don't know. I mean, about Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich continuing to bloody each other up, aided by Rick Santorum and Ron Paul. You know, I don't think they are, because there's a billion-dollar marketing campaign that's just itching for a crosshair. And as long as there are four candidates up there, I don't think they can aim at any one person. I think it's, you know, it's the Republican nominee show. It's all about them right now. And for the most part, it's all pretty good news. It's all pretty upbeat. We're vetting all the problems. We're polishing. We're vetting. I think somewhere in it, you know, all the laundry is going to be aired, although... You know, I don't think that we're going to get anything new on Ron Paul, because he's been saying the same thing for 20 years. And, you know, finally, liberty has become fashionable, and he's doing rather well. And, you know, we have officially endorsed him here because, you know, he's so unoffensive, and he really, you know, matches the mindset of this program, because if we do have to have politics, I'd rather have his. I mean, because it just doesn't harsh my gig at all. Anyway, why would this go on for a while? Because a combination of an elongated schedule, new Republican National Committee rules, and some quirks of fate have diminished the importance of individual contests and reduced the ability for really what they call knockout punches. I don't know why they have to beat each other up the way they do. I mean, can't they just, you know, do their hair differently each debate and talk about different subjects? Sooner or later, we'll make up our minds, but they don't really have to beat each other up. There's plenty to beat up out there besides themselves. Part of the reason for this schedule is RNC, or well, then RNC Chair Michael Steele wants an extended primary season so as to ensure a strong nominee. The elongated Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton race indubitably made Obama a better candidate, although we still didn't learn anything about the guy. Because, I mean, who knew him? He was a community organizer, whatever that is. I guess you can find out if you read Saul Alinsky's book Radical. Rules for Radicalism. Maybe you can find out for yourself. But top Democrats are hoping that won't happen with the GOP race, that it will just provide more moments of Romney calling Gingrich erratic and Gingrich calling into question Romney's business practices, blah, 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 blah. Although, I got to tell you, folks, I never even thought about having a Cayman account, a Swiss account. What's going on with that? Jeez Louise, he never even lived in Switzerland. So here's how top Democrats see it. On January 31st comes the Florida primary. Okay, that's in a couple days, Tuesday, 2 days from now. As we know, this is going to be big fun because it's been a while since we had the last debate. And the debates are live TV. You know, it's not taped. It's not like, okay, listen, you didn't really deliver that well, so we're going to take another take. Take two, take three, take four. It doesn't work that way. All the sweat, all the stuttering, all the eye shifting, hand leaning, you know, is real and live, just like live TV. And to make it even more interesting, there are 500 or 600 people that they don't even know out there in the audience one time who were admonished by the network they could not clap or cheer or the whole thing was going to be shut down. And the next one, they did cheer. So even the audience didn't know what to do. So this is how it goes. Because the Sunshine State has opted to hold its primary on an earlier date than the RNC had sanctioned, Florida's 99 delegates have been shrunk to 50 as a penalty. Yeah, lessening the state's impact on the overall nomination process. These delegates will be winner-take-all. It's not like Iowa where, you know, Ron Paul got a certain portion of the delegates and Rick Santorum got a certain portion of the delegates, et cetera, et cetera. This is a winner-take-all. So whoever wins, Romney, Gingrich, Santorum, Paul, it's unlikely that the other three will drop out. It's just not that dramatic, regardless of what you've heard all the pundits say on TV. If Romney wins, he has all the momentum, blah, blah, blah. That's nonsense. Each of the top three have won a state, and Paul, believe it or not, has been picking up delegates in every state. Wouldn't it just be fun, just fun, if Ron won Florida? Four states, four winners. Folks, it doesn't get any better than that. It's the best ticket in town. As of now, Romney, Gingrich, and Santorum can brag about winning one contest each. One of their rivals jumping to two doesn't change the dynamic all that much, they can argue, especially when all it means is that 50 delegates out of 1,144 needed to win the GOP presidential nomination. That's a small amount. What comes after Florida? Well, February brings four GOP caucuses. These are not primaries. These are caucuses. They work a little bit like Iowa. They count up the votes manually, total up the sheets, submit the total sheets to a central reporting station, and they announce the winner, and they divide up the delegates. So you got Colorado, Maine, Minnesota, Nevada. And, you know, that's a whole month for just 128 delegates, 5% of the total that can be won. All of these 128 delegates will be allocated proportionately. So it's not winner-take-all. It could even out rather nicely. This won't encourage anyone to drop out. If you've got the money, you can stay in the race. That's all there is to it. Third-place finishers and caucus can still get delegates. February ends with winner-take-all primaries in two other states that have been penalized by the RNC, Michigan and Arizona. Both Michigan and Arizona are, it is reported, to be the advantage of Romney because Romney is from Michigan and Arizona is mostly Mormon. But there's a total of 116 delegates there in those two states. All of this means that by the end of February, 85% of the delegates will still not have been awarded. So we go shooting into March. Then comes Super Tuesday, which isn't all that super this year, diminishing the opportunity for a knockout punch. It comes a month later in this election cycle than it did in 2008, on March 6th versus February 5th in 2008. In this year's Super Tuesday, a smaller number of delegates will be at stake, 466 delegates in 11 states this year versus 1,069 delegates in 21 states in 2008. Gingrich will probably do well in his home state of Georgia and other southern states such as Tennessee. Romney and Paul are the only ones on the Virginia ballot, and he will no doubt romp in Massachusetts and Vermont because, well, they're moderates. Okay. They're liberals, spelt with an M, okay? Plus, many, many more of this year's Super Tuesday delegates will be awarded proportionally as opposed to winner-take-all races. After Super Tuesday, 64% of the total delegates will still be at stake, which means you could have won none of the delegates up to and passing Super Tuesday and then win from there on and still get the nomination, with 28 states not having yet voted after Super Tuesday. April showers bring some winner-take-all showers that might allow Mitt Romney to build some delegate momentum. Maybe. I say might if he's not hobbling by then. You know, there's still all the stuff about the Michael Milliken involved. Michael Milliken. Oh, Google it, okay? He was the junk bond architect, okay? He tanked more people than any savings and loan scandal that you can imagine. He basically sold worthless paper, and it required investors and complicit banks to make it work. And people died because of this. Yeah, I'm not kidding, because some of the investments that were tanked during this, literally forced into oblivion by market-making bad press, were life-saving treatments for things like diabetes and heart disease, and all in the name of the mighty dollar. The companies that created these treatments were tanked, driven into bankruptcy, so that these junk bond traders could continue to make their money. Romney was in the thick of it. He was up to his belt buckles, all of them, with Michael Milliken. It hasn't even come out yet, people. So there's a lot to go. But, you know, there are other states that are holding primaries in April. Texas primary on April 3rd. I don't know if Romney will do so well there since Governor Perry endorsed Newt. The governor, of course, has endorsed Newt. And the 155 delegates in Texas are winner-take-all. So it could be interesting. I mean, just it's going to be the best show in town. You need to buy plenty of microwave popcorn and get ready for it. Because, you know, at the end of the day, this moving target, this carnival, you know, mainline entertainment with balloons and moving targets and pellet guns, yeah, it's just a Mardi Gras for the Democratic Party. They got $1 billion of the advertising. Not all of it was raised by the president. He's got about $30 million to spend on the I'm Barack Obama and I approve this message kind of commercials. But there are several super PACs and lots of complicit publicity providers like newspapers and television stations and radio networks that are all in Obama's back pocket. So they're all going to be running PSAs, public service announcements, and super PAC ads without having to come out of Obama's pocket. Trust me, it's $1 billion. $1 billion for a job that pays about $400,000 a year. Go figure. It's just amazing, people. But the cool thing is that maybe with today's style of communication, our ability to exchange ideas and really get the truth out, and of course vet all the emotions, whether it's in social media or email or blogs or whatever, it's so sophisticated now and so rapid fire that maybe, just maybe, we, the people, will choose our own candidate instead of having it chosen for us. Wouldn't that be cool? That would be cool. After it's all said and done, Ron Paul wins. I just think it would be cool to piss him off, don't you? Just awesome. Well, Newt Gingrich speaking of campaign speeches, and one of the reasons why I love bringing this up, you know that the campaign for the Republican nominee is now in Florida. And Florida is famous for, no, not Mickey Mouse. Florida's famous for space, NASA, and all that stuff. I mean, come on. Newt Gingrich took the opportunity of being on Florida's space coast to revisit one of his favorite topics, mine too, space exploration. Now, it's right up there, you know, here at X Squared Radio. It's one of our favorite things to talk about. He says, by the end of my second term, we will have the first permanent base on the moon, and it will be American, Gingrich said to applause. He said the development would include commercial and private efforts and will make apparent we clearly have the capacity that Chinese and the Russians will never come anywhere close to us. Gingrich also said he would push to develop propulsion technology that would get man to Mars. That would be pretty easy to do if we were leaving from the moon. He emphasized that it doesn't have to be expensive. Exploration in partnership with private companies can lower the cost. He says if it's cheaper and it's faster and it works, do it, he said. He also said launch areas should be capable of launching multiple spacecrafts in a single day, like an airport. Does that mean I'm visionary, he says? You betcha. Well, I don't think it's all that visionary. I mean, we just have to remember what we were doing in the late 60s and early 70s. Oh, yeah, now we have real computers that we could put on board the spacecraft. But the other thing is that right now there are 69 active space programs going all the way out, as I said, you know, 25,000 light years into space looking for habitable planets that we will never be able to access. Maybe looking for ET, which I highly doubt. I just don't think it's productive, folks. We're spending in the trillions of dollars to get out there because some of it is just pure exploration and some of it's defense-minded, especially the stuff that's in orbit. But we're talking about our own satellite 3 days away, 3 days travel from here, and that's it, old technology. You know, we could get there in a weekend. It's not like 3 months to get to Mars. You can almost hold your breath for 3 days until a rescue ship gets there. We could do this. We could do this. The thing that appalls me, that just floors me, is that it's been 40 years and we have not been back to the moon. No one. I mean, we've flown around it. China and Japan, and they've all taken pictures of it pretty close. I don't think we have all that data either. But I can tell you right now, China has it on. They got game on. They're going to the moon. And if they build a base on the moon first, well, they have a base on the moon. They have a base on the moon. What would that do to our national pride? I think it's a great goal. It's not a waste of taxpayer dollars because we would get private industry involved in it as well. Also, this in the news. By the way, I want to let you know, we got about 20 minutes and Hallie Evelyn's going to be coming on. She's going to be talking about her book, Red Goddess Rising. I highly recommend the book. And I'll tell you why when we get to the top of the hour. It is a story of a tour guide's growth going back and forth between the U.S. and Egypt. But it's going to be fascinating. Hallie is an amazingly fascinating personality. She's a screenwriter. The book is extremely well written. It can be got on Amazon at Amazon.com, or you can go to xsquaredradio.com and you can click on the Red Goddess Rising book cover down in the affiliates area and go right there. No problem. Now, this in the news. Many of you will be happy about this. I know I was. Fried foods are okay. Yeah. Can you believe it? All the butt whoopings we've taken literally over the last 20 years over fried foods, and a new study has come out. Yeah, it's good. Fried foods are okay. Dividing participants into four groups from lowest fried food intake to highest, they found no repeat, no significant difference in heart disease. Ta-da! There were 606 incidents linked to heart disease in total, but they were split relatively evenly between the four groups. Imagine that. All the bean sprout eating vegetarian raw food, blah, 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 folks had just as many heart attacks as the French fry eaters. Something's just justice about that. Come on. The authors concluded in a Mediterranean country where olive and sunflower oils are the most commonly used fats for frying, and where large amounts of fried foods are consumed both at and away from home, no association was observed between fried food consumption and the risk of coronary heart disease or death. Mississippi is happy today. That's right. We love it. We love it. It's awesome. Commenting on the findings in the BMU, Professor Michael Leitzmann of the University of Regensburg in Germany said two other studies, one from Costa Rica and another by an international team, had also failed to find strong evidence of a link. So this wasn't just local. This was a global study. He said, taken together, the myth that frying food is generally bad for the heart is not supported by the evidence. I love it. I think it's great. Now, they didn't say anything about butter, okay? So lay off the butter. But soy oil and the like, good stuff. Olive oil, way to go. Good stuff. We also have a global warming update. It's solar cycle 25 we need to worry about. And if NASA scientists are right, the Thames will be freezing over again. Sorry to say. They say there's been no global warming in 15 years. The supposed consensus of man-made global warming is facing an inconvenient challenge after the release of new temperature data showing the planet has not warmed for the past 15 years. We've been saying that here on this program for several years. It isn't the mean temperature of the planet that is the problem, folks. It is the wild swings between the extreme cold and the extreme warmth. And I noticed that this was printed earlier this year. And here we are almost to February. And I hate to tell you, folks, but we haven't had a winter yet. Yeah, I don't think we're going to. We got about 6 weeks on the calendar for winter to show up. And I think it's going to be a no-call, no-show. So if we're going to take the mean temperature of this year, you might have a little blip in your graph there. Based on readings from more than 30,000 measuring statements, the data was issued last week without fanfare by the Met Office and the University of East Anglia Climatic Research Unit. It confirms that the rising trend in world temperatures ended in 1997. We said 1998, so we're pretty close on that. Solar output goes through 11-year cycles, with high numbers of sunspots seen at their peak. We are now at what should be the peak of what scientists call solar cycle 24, which is why last week's solar storm resulted in sightings of the aurora borealis further south than usual. But sunspot numbers are running at less than half those seen during cycle peaks in the 20th century. It's true. We went something like 1,000 days without a sunspot. Analysis by experts at NASA and the University of Arizona derived from magnetic field measurements 120,000 miles between the sun's surface suggest that cycle 25, whose peak is due in 2022, will be a great deal weaker still. Yeah, well, they thought that 2012 was going to be a scorcher. They thought that the sunspots would just be devastating. But they haven't been. Although, I've got to tell you, we've dodged several bullets in the last 12 months. interesting stuff. World temperatures may end up a lot cooler than now for 50 years or more, says Henrik Svensmark, director of the Center for Sun Climate Research at Denmark's National Space Institute. He goes on to say, it will take a long battle to convince some climate scientists that the sun is important. It may well be that the sun is going to demonstrate this on its own without the need for their help. It's kind of smug, don't you think? 888-429-5471 if you want to be part of the program. So, global warming, climate change. I could tell you climate change is upon us. We may not be changing in mean temperature much, but so many ecosystems, so many biological systems and balances have changed in the last 10 years. There is absolutely no denying that climate change is upon us. All right, let's see here. Let me run down through here. I got a couple more news stories, and then we're going to get Hallie on here. We have about 10 minutes to the top of the hour, and Hallie Evelyn's going to be coming on to talk about her book, Red Goddess Rising, if you're just joining us. It's a great travel memoir of an Egyptian-American tour guide of Egypt. And I think you're going to find it interesting. Even if you've been to Egypt, I suggest that you listen in because it's going to be a good interview. One of the things that we talk about often on this program is alternative energy. And, you know, part of the challenge, of course, is getting all the circuits to work and getting the exotic materials to behave themselves and being able to, you know, find suppliers and file patents and protect your intellectual property and on and on and on. But the other challenge is money. And the story headline is drip, 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 yet another green energy stimulus recipient hits the skids, the third this week. And this is a story by William Yeatman. It's a blog that came out a couple days ago. And it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way, and I wanted to put my perspective on it, And I want you to share your opinions with me, because I don't think there's a lot of conspiracy here, like, you know, a bunch of oil companies trying to kill stuff. But there is, you know, some subterfuge going on here, and I just want to discuss it with you. Earlier this week, stimulus beneficiary Evergreen Energy bit the dust. Then Inner One. That's Inner, like the short for energy, and the number one, Inner One, a manufacturer of batteries for electric vehicles and a recipient of stimulus largesse, both filed for bankruptcy. And today, the Las Vegas Sun reports that Ammonix, Inc., a manufacturer of solar panels that received $5.9 million from the Porculus, will cut two-thirds of its workforce, about 200 employees, only 7 months after opening a factory in Nevada. The author says he foresaw this spate of bad news last November. In a previous post, he compares renewable energy spending in 2009 stimulus to a green albatross burdening the president. He argues that stimulus spending was inherently wasteful because politics invariably corrupts government's investment decisions. The result is taxpayer losses on bankrupt companies that existed only by the grace of political favoritism, a la Solyndra. He predicted the green stimulus would haunt the president in the form of a slow drip public relations nightmare as a litany of bad investments go belly up in the run to the 2012 election. He goes on to say, Mr. President, are you still sure you want to double down on renewable energy giveaways? Well, I disagree with William on this article. I am positive he has never applied for any stimulus funds like a grant or a loan guarantee from the Department of Energy or anybody else. When I spoke at length with the Department of Energy, there is one thing that is pretty evident. I asked the project officer why the DOE makes these investments over the last 20 years. He said, because many of these technologies have never had any revenue. and they need a risk partner to make a go of it. The taxpayer has always been that risk partner, he said. Whether it is a national renewable energy lab, and there are many of them around the country, or a private enterprise trying to introduce a disruptive technology, the taxpayer helps shoulder the risk with loan guarantees or grants. Because I guarantee you, they can't go to the bank and borrow money because it's never been done before. Some people do an SBA grant and they leverage their house and lose it. They leverage the farm and lose it. They get private investors to back them and they lose their money. So they go to the government, and the government has always been the risk partner. So I asked him, how many of these risky projects actually pay back the loans? He told me, almost none of them. So I said, let me ask the question another way. How many of the borrowers default on their loans? And he said, actually, almost all of them. Very few actually succeed the first time out, he said. So here's the real truth, Earth Explorers. When the Department of Energy sends money out, it goes straight up a horse's rear. It always has. Green, black, brown, white, it doesn't matter. Government, departments, private enterprise, universities, it's all lost, okay? This is all political subterfuge, and the reporter knows it. The taxpayer is never paid back, okay? Well, not exactly. I mean, when small business receives it, nearly 100% of the money is spent right at home. It does create jobs. It furthers the technology that will either be absorbed into another larger company or will make some headway and come out at a later time. The National Renewable Energy Lab also benefits from the technology that's transferred if it isn't protected in the grant process. And the government will use it elsewhere, or the companies will use it elsewhere. To single out green energy companies is not at all accurate, and it is disingenuous. The other thing is this. Obama has made a part of his legacy to break down the barriers for green energy to come to the consumer. I like it. The guy that gets up and holds that mic or reads that teleprompter or speaks impromptu and talks about innovation, talks about solar energy, talks about wind energy, talks about electric vehicles, that's the guy I like. Now, it might be that as the programs get implemented, it does take a shift. It could be that the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. This is the State of the Union clip from last year, okay? Now, I want you to see if this sounds familiar. We just had the State of the Union thing here just a couple days ago, so it should be, it probably isn't, but should be fresh in your mind. But I want you to hear this one, and just tell me, if this sounds familiar. Okay, this is Obama's State of the Union address 1 year ago.
We need to get behind this innovation. And to help pay for it, I'm asking Congress to eliminate the billions in taxpayer dollars we currently give to oil companies. I don't know if you've noticed, but they're doing just fine on their own. So instead of subsidizing yesterday's energy, let's invest in tomorrow's. Now, clean energy breakthroughs will only translate into clean energy jobs if businesses know there will be a market for what they're selling. So tonight, I challenge you to join me in setting a new goal. By 2035, 80% of America's electricity will come from clean energy sources. Some folks want wind and solar. Others want nuclear, clean coal, and natural gas. To meet this goal, we will need them all. And I urge Democrats and Republicans to work together to make it happen.
I know who I am. I'm a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude.
Okay. Well, anyway, that sounded pretty familiar. So as you can see here, he is claiming to shift oil dollars to green companies. Does anyone think that that actually happened? Well, actually, 80% of the stimulus funds went to bundlers and companies who wrote large checks to the administration. That's a fact, people. There was very little, if any, proof that they had a product anyone could buy. Case in point, this week we heard about EnerOne going bankrupt. I just told you about it after $118 million in stimulus funds were given in 2009. Well, I actually called EnerOne many times in 2008 and 2009 trying to buy their product. Guess what? They had none for sale. That's right. Zero of their products were for sale. Well, how can you hope to make money if your product is not for sale? I mean, why? Why in the world would anyone, let alone founders, managers, workers, investors, and the DOE, want to just sit there spending research funds and never make any money? Well, I'm glad you asked. As it turns out, there is another agency that targets these new businesses and stops them from selling anything. You would think that the right hand would know what the left foot is doing, but the left foot of the EPA is standing on the necks of small business and new technologies, preventing it from reaching consumers. It's true. It's true. I have the audio. Hold on 1 second, and you'll hear it for yourself. This is how bad it gets when the EPA is systematically taking out new technology. Well, I said I was going to do it. I really did. I meant to. It was my intention to. Let's see what happens here, see if it'll work. All right. Well, it doesn't seem to be cooperating. From electric cars to batteries to solar panels to wind generators, wave power generators, and even geothermal power sources, they've all been stomped into piles of red tape, litigation, fines, and labeling requirements that have made it impossible for these new technologies to come to market. One of the biggest reasons that green energy companies go broke is because the EPA is actively hunting them down and stopping them. And there's nothing you can do about it either. The EPA officials are appointed by the president. They are not elected. The Senate has no review process, as you just recently saw. The states are in the dark. The consumer doesn't have a clue. And they hire the most activist lawyers and pay off the most powerful judges in the country. The EPA does not consider impact on jobs in their economic analysis. They collect fines while they use almost exclusively the courts to accomplish their regulation process development. The amount of regulations built by lawyers through careful court planning total in the tens of thousands per year. These regulations are often so technical and based upon judicial activities that most congressmen can't keep up with that and run for office and fundraising activities year-round. The loser is the small business that cannot afford a technical attorney. Now, I'm just going to play a little bit of this for you because this is a congressional investigation into the EPA. The EPA guy is there answering questions, and one of the legislators is asking him questions about creating jobs. Pay close attention to this. This is really hilarious.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for joining us today. And I want to go back to a series of questions that you answered with the chairman regarding economic analysis. You stated in later questioning that the EPA would not propose a rule where the costs exceed the benefits. Earlier, though, you said that, and you said that you did an economic analysis, but that economic analysis did not do a jobs analysis. Is it standard procedure for an economic analysis to ignore the impact on jobs?
Well, we didn't do a direct analysis, and again, we saw it further.
So you did not do a direct economic analysis?
No. We did a direct economic analysis of the various potential costs that we've identified, which includes cost of compliance by the utility sector, the cost to the states, as well as various benefits.
But not a cost on jobs?
Not directly.
So what you did do a cost on jobs then? Indirectly?
Well, we just looked at the direct cost from complying with the rule.
So you did or you did not do jobs?
No.
So is it standard procedure then for an economic analysis to not include jobs?
Well, and I can get back to on the specific details of how we do economic analysis. We do economic analysis based on this, the direct consequence of our rule.
So you don't think your rule will have direct consequences on jobs?
Well, I mean, we did an analysis of the various costs of that, and clearly we're cognizant of the economic consequence of our rule. So
it does have an economic consequence?
Sure, but we looked at both the cost and benefits of the rule.
But you didn't look at jobs?
Not directly, no. So we looked at, for example, the impact on the utility industry.
I'm sorry, I can't listen to it anymore. Okay, well, you get the idea. This is what the EPA does when they're hauled up there to Congress to say, what the heck are you guys doing? So now you know what's going on. You have the facts. You have the total facts up to the minute of what's going on. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll bring our author on, Hallie Evelyn. We'll talk about her book, Red Goddess Rising. Give us about 4 minutes. Drink something cold. Loosen your seatbelt a little bit. Relax. This next segment isn't going to be nearly as intense. Well, it could be. It depends on how crazy we get. We'll be back in about 4 minutes with Hallie Evelyn. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio after this. To the second hour of X Squared Radio here on the BBS Radio Network. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 45 degrees and clear. Jupiter just above a fingernail moon. Sirius, just to the east. My guest tonight is Hallie Evelyn. Hallie went to Egypt a disinterested atheist with a paralyzing fear of death. Just another tourist on vacation, but somewhere in the middle of exploring the fascinating mix of developing country and ancient monuments, she found the unexpected revelation of her soul. Travel up the Nile with Hallie as she recounts timeless, riveting stories of both ancient and modern Egypt, of her own awakening, and the changes in the lives of the people she now guides. Growing up without religion, Hallie's almost debilitating fear of death was the nasty secret in her otherwise comfortable, if unexamined, life. When her partner invited her on a spiritual tour of Egypt, Hallie agreed without knowing what she was getting herself into. What followed was beyond her wildest expectations, triggering a deeper understanding of self she didn't even know could exist, and putting Hallie on the path to lead her own spiritual journeys. Hallie Evelyn is Julie the Cruise Director for Spirit Quest Tours and a spiritual seeker of truth. She is delightedly attached to her partner, Greg, and counts amazing people all over the world as her friends, including me. When she is not traveling, Hallie writes screenplays and edits. Red Goddess Rising is her first travel book. I've read it. I think it's amazing. She and her husband, Greg, lead tours to Bali as a Time magazine publicized and critically acclaimed Eat, Pray, Love tour company, to amazing and life-altering Bhutan, the eco-safari of South Africa, and fabled India. I have co-sponsored a trip with them to Egypt just before the Twitter revolt, and I will never do a tour with anyone else. They are the best of the best. The adventurers never end with Hallie. And now she is with us tonight to discuss her amazing book, Red Goddess Rising. Welcome, Hallie. How are you? Yeah, there she is. I love this. I love live radio. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Shall I repeat what I said then?
Yes, you should repeat what you said.
I said, after that introduction, I am fabulous, Brooke. Thank you.
Well, that's it then. The interview's over. all right. Red Goddess Rising. Now, I know you've been working on this for a while, and you've made lots of trips to Egypt. And our last trip together, you made one since then, but our last trip together, we're in not really downtown Cairo, but we're, just to give you an idea how cool this was, the place where we stayed, you could sit in the living room chair and look out the window at the Giza Plateau. Literally, you could look at the Great Pyramid out your window. That's how cool it was. So, you know, we got up one morning and the house was kind of quiet. We're waiting for all the other people to get up, and I said, Hallie, there's a pyramid outside.
Actually, I think, Brooks, it is the only apartment building in Egypt that I'm aware of where on the floor that we were staying, you actually have a view from the guest bathroom of the pyramids. It's that good. So,
wow. Well, I know my life was complete. I could die, right?
Yes,
I can tell you that. You know, millions and millions of tourists have gone to see the pyramids. And I'm sure they've had the bus tours and they've shuffled in and shuffled out. And, you know, in their out of condition tourist, you know, neck hanging camera way. But we didn't do that. When you go with Hallie, describe what we do when we go to the pyramids.
Well, our objective, not just for the Great Pyramids, but in general with all of our guests on as many of our tours as possible, but absolutely on the Egypt trip, is to give people really special, personalized five-star experience. So we went and stood between the paws of the Sphinx. We went and had private time, a private visit for a couple hours in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. So we all got to crawl around in there and do, you know, meditations and ceremonies in there as well. Basically, the idea behind our Egypt trips is to awaken the spirituality of the latent, often, spirituality inside of you. And so going to these incredible power centers and then doing spiritual work there is why we go. And that's really hard to do when there's all these other tourists around. The camera from the neck hanging ones that you just described, which our main guide over there calls tourists. He calls them tourists to differentiate them from, like, the pilgrims, which are the regular tourists or the spiritual seekers. So the tourists look at the outside of the pyramid, but we go in. The tourists stand at the exterior of the Sphinx enclosure, and we go in and go and stand down between the paws of the Sphinx. And then we get private time in most of the temples as well.
Well, I found what was fascinating is when we went into the pyramid, it wasn't like we were there with 50 other tourists. It was just us. When we went into the King's Chamber, we it wasn't part of the plan, but it just seemed to work out this way. We each got our own individual time in, I'm going to call it the dream box, because it was not a sarcophagus. Nothing was ever buried in the pyramid.
Right.
People still call it the sarcophagus. It isn't. And if you get to lay in it, and if you go on one of Hallie and Greg's tours, which I highly recommend that you go to Spirit Quest Tours and check it out, sign up. We may sponsor another one. In fact, I'm leaning heavily toward it, even though Egypt is what it is today. And we're going to discuss that later on in the program, just so you know what's going on the streets, behind the scenes, not covered by the press. What we found is that we worked our way around to where we chanted, and I don't know how to put it any other way, but the resonance inside this chamber was nothing short of phenomenal. Now here's, I don't know if Hallie knows this or not, because sitting on my backpack over at the side against the wall was my high-definition digital camera in infrared filming the whole thing.
I didn't know that, you sneaky man.
It's very cool. Hey, we all look very svelte in infrared.
I bet.
Well, but it was cool.
The decay time, the mean decay time, Greg is so much better at this than I am. Okay, the mean decay time of how long it takes a sound to hit the wall from the center of the room or something like that, in Roswell Chapel is like so incredible that it is where a lot of choirs perform and record their music. And it's in a space that's like, I'm going to say maybe like 20 times the size of the King's Chamber. But the mean decay time inside of the King's Chamber is higher than that, and it's so much smaller. And it's because the quality of the resonance, because of the stone in the King's Chamber, is off the hook. I mean, I've had a stonemason inside of the Great Pyramid with me, and he's telling me, you cannot put a piece of paper between these stones. He's telling me there is no physical way that we have the capability to build this building today, even given our technology and the perfection of the laser-like cuts of the stones. We just don't have that capability. And there's something so special about every space in the Great Pyramid. But, yeah, we don't call it the sarcophagus either. We call it the coffer. The idea is that you get down into, Greg reminded me, the mean decay time is better than at Newcastle Cathedral, it's not Roswell Chapel, it's Newcastle Cathedral in the UK. And, the Great Pyramid, everything in there, I believe, is designed for a a specific purpose. Now, it may not be something that we understand today, but it's powerful. And we do put people, when you go into the King's Chamber with us, we're putting you into the coffer. You're going through an initiation process. And that initiation process for everybody on our trip is the culmination of 2 weeks in Egypt. And my first trip up the Nile as a completely ignorant tourist accompanying my husband, the spiritual seeker, you know, by the time I got to the King's Chamber, I was like, you know, if not fully awake, at least no longer asleep. And so going into the King's Chamber and going into the coffer was part of my awakening process. And it's an amazing experience to get to do that because you basically come out different than when you went in. And for some people, it can be a life-changing moment.
Yeah, it is quite fascinating. I resolved that I was not going to close my eyes when I got in there. I laid down and I stared up at the ceiling. And we each got a couple of minutes, 2 or 3 minutes of this chanting, but can you imagine, you know, taking an hour of that being in? I think you'd just have an out-of-body experience. The reason I wanted to start with that as the beginning of the program is I didn't want to lose any of our listeners because the whole tour is really a building up to this moment. When we arrive in Cairo, and Cairo's an amazing city of 20 million people, no traffic lights, and a significant portion of the city has no running water. I mean, literally, when we talk about the city of the dead, we're talking about a city that lives in an ancient cemetery because there are no living quarters in the city.
Yep, there's 500,000 people in the city of the dead today.
Yeah, and we've driven around it in a cab with no more than 3/4 of an inch of clearance between our vehicle and all the vehicles on all sides. And we didn't hit anything. It was amazing. But long story short is we get on this boat. Now, it isn't an ordinary boat. What's the boat called for our listeners?
The Afandina.
And what style of boat is it?
The Afandina, which is the name means the old king. The Afandina is a dahabeah, and the dahabeahs are the former sailing ships of the Nile before there were the big cruise ships. And compared to a big cruise ship like a Carnival Cruise Line or something, these are not big. These are 80, 100-room cruise ships. They're relatively, they're nice size. There's, you know, the ones we take anyway, they have, all, you know, views from every cabin has a gorgeous view of the Nile. And the dahabeahs are, they used to be the way that people sailed the Nile before there were the bigger cruise ships. And the one that that we're on belongs to our wonderful partners, Quest Travel in Egypt, who we've been working with since my first trip to Egypt 12 years ago. And Mohammed Nazmi, who's the owner of Quest Travel, built this dahabeah like the boats of old. And when I say the boats of old, Caesar and Cleopatra honeymooned on a dahabeah. When Howard Carter was trying to raise money for the Tutankhamun excavations, he would go from salon to salon, chatting up all the British people who were visiting. You know, they were wintering in Egypt, and this was in the late 1800s, and he was going from salon to salon, not in their homes, but on their dahabeahs, because they would be sailing the Nile for the winter. So it was more of a houseboat where there were staterooms, and then there was a living room and a dining room and a full kitchen, and that's what we have on this dahabeah. There are 8 staterooms that are lovely, as you know, and then everything else is all designed to have this, you know, group of 16 people be pampered just completely by your private chef and, you know, the jacuzzi on the deck, and it's just, as you sail down the Nile, it's just really delightful.
So what's it like to lay on one of the deck lounges and look up at Orion above your head on the Nile, as you're going down the river?
I have to say, there is something about looking up at the night sky in Egypt as you're sailing down the Nile that is one of the most peaceful and connecting moments. It's like you realize how small you are in the universe and how big the universe is, but at the same time you realize that you're connected with all living things. And so it's this moment of tininess and this moment of greatness all at once, as above, so below. And so that's what it feels like when you lie on that deck chair and sail down the Nile looking up at Orion.
It's way cool. Now, the interesting the Dahabeah is, it is actually a sailing vessel. It doesn't have any method of powering itself up or down the river. So in order to make navigation predictable, it's actually pushed by a tug. But it doesn't have any, it doesn't go under its own power. Is that right?
Yes, but the Dahabeah does have sails because that's how they used to get around. And so when we sail, and normally when you sail the Nile on a cruise ship, you get 4 nights. When we have the Dahabeah, we do 8 nights. And it's 2 reasons. One is that we can choose to take the tug and push the boat slower. The cruise ships have schedules to keep, and we have no real schedule to keep when we're on the Afandina. So we do have the boat go more slowly, and then also we can ask them to stop and take put the sails up, and then we'll sail for dinner, let's say. And they literally will just sail around for a while or sail down the Nile a little bit. The current with the Nile is swift enough in some places that it can, you know, the Dahabeah, between the wind picking up the sails and the current, it can actually be under sail, but we would go more slowly. So in order to get there, you know, to get between Aswan and Luxor, which are the two cities that we're traveling between, in some decent amount of time, we do have the tugboat and we do use it. But I like sailing best because because there's something sort of ancient and miraculous about it, and also because it's very quiet, peaceful, pastoral, idyllic, all those wonderful words that when you would use about sailing down the Nile, they're all perfect right there.
Now, this is the setting in which or through which your book was developed. It is a novel, yes, but it is more like a memoir. It's not really stories that are fictional. It's actual events that happen, actual transformation, the thoughts of Hallie and observations from her first-person point of view. But this is the setting by which this was developed. So this wasn't an old hand at, Michael or Michener traveling the world, describing every dish and every, you know, spiritual ritual that you can go through. This is a newbie that develops in the book and reaches a point of, I'm going to call it metamorphosis in the book. And you're going to do a reading for us of one of the metamorphoses that occurred in this book because, you know, in your childhood and early adulthood, you had this wall that you kept hitting in certain conditions. And you reached those conditions in a very auspicious place and a change occurred.
Yeah. Now, when I was a kid, I went to my dad. I was like 10 years old, and I was like, you know, Dad, where do you go when you die? And he tells me, because he's an atheist, a massive, like, complete atheist my entire life, he tells me, you go in the ground and the worms eat you. And I was like, oh, that's not good. And so that started this series of panic attacks that I had from the time that I was 10 until my first trip to Egypt. And like every week to every month, I would, as you say, hit this wall where I would, like, for example, I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would be completely freaking out because I wouldn't be able to see anything except this black, and I was just sure that I wasn't going to be me anymore and that it was just going to be dreadful. And so I would jump out of bed and run around until I, like, could calm myself. But it was a desperate and difficult situation for a kid to be in. And in the book, I make a joke. I'm like, hey, parents, tell your children about the sunny meadows and the flowers until they get old enough to be, teens in full-on rebellion, and then maybe you can tell them the truth. But at the time, my dad thought he was doing me a favor in getting rid of all that religion stuff that he didn't like, which is what made him an atheist. And so I was kind of, stuck with this, and it was really terrible. And then I couldn't tell anybody because it was really dreadful. So my first trip to Egypt, Greg had already had a lot of he had a background that was, comparative religion, and then he had become a Rosicrucian, and it was actually a Rosicrucian trip to Egypt that we were on. And he was like, hey, do you want to go? And I'm like, yeah, that sounds a vacation, yay. So, because we were working so much. So that's my whole way. That's the whole reason I'm in Egypt is I'm like, hey, vacation, yes, let's go. So I had really no idea what to expect. And I had this incredibly powerful spiritual awakening in Egypt that healed my panic attacks. And literally, I have never had another one since, ever. But that, of course, is the climax of the book. So the reading that I've chosen for this evening is a lot earlier in the book. It's in the Valley of the Kings.
Oh, that's right.
And I was going to read to you about the about this panic attack that I had in Tomb. So is that okay to read that?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. My memory of the Valley of the Kings, I went there. I'm thinking it was in January. So this is the Egyptian winter, which is about 60, 65 degrees, which is, that's a Scottish summer for me, so I'm fine. The Egyptians running around in down jackets, blowing on their hands. We're left running around in shorts and drinking a Coke. But the Valley of the Kings is a wasteland. It is like, you go out there and you think this is really going to be a majestic kind of avenue of the stars kind of place. It isn't. It's just... I don't even know how they found this stuff. I guess they just treasure seekers just kept digging until they found it. But the tombs themselves are really quite spectacular.
Yeah, there are these caves on the side of the mountain, and their caves all have mouths in them that are visible from way down below. So I think maybe that's where some of the earlier tomb robbings came in, and also the idea of let's put our tombs in there. Because you could see these caves, and there are there are hundreds of cave of tomb wall. Of openings that have now been made into tombs. But they say that they've only uncovered 20% of the tombs in the Valley of the Kings.
Well, the strange thing that I found is as I was walking along, and I have a tendency to look down. When I'm walking along, I don't know, maybe it's my low self-esteem. I'm kidding.
You're looking for money, Brooks, right?
No, it was all, gravel, I thought. But I looked down, and guess what I found? I found a whole, complete, petrified clam. And I thought to myself, what the heck is this doing up here? And I realized that maybe anciently all of this was underwater.
Yeah, there are some seashells, petrified seashells, and seashell shapes in the rocks in some of those areas. Absolutely. I would say I've seen stuff like that as well, and also a lot of little seashells that basically have become, as you said, the gravel in some areas. So yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, in any case, this is the setting that you go, you pay your 5 Egyptian pounds or whatever it is.
About 60 these days.
and you make your trek down into a hot hole in the ground. Some of it has steps and some of it's, kind of a slanted walkway. And when you get down there, it's quite fascinating how well preserved it is. One of the things that I noticed right away is there's no soot on any of the walls. So however they dug this stuff and however meticulously they painted and carved and, constructed things down there, they either did it in the dark or they had a different way of lighting these caves than we can figure out.
I have been down in one of the crypts Dendera Temple. The crypts are usually off limits to visitors. Of course, we're the bad kids, so we take our groups down there. We bribe the guards and go down into the crypts. But they're bizarre, and they're really amazing. Like, imagine, like, you go down, like, maybe five steps, and then you kind of duck walk under, and then when you come up into the crypt itself, they're about 30 feet long, these shafts, about 30 feet long, and there's two of them, one to the left and one to the right, and the walls are completely carved in hieroglyphics, and there is exactly enough room for maybe two people to stand shoulder to shoulder, and their shoulders would be hitting the wall. So, I mean, they're very narrow, and they're only tall enough for about a six-foot-tall man to stand in. And they're completely carved with hieroglyphs. And again, as you said, there's no soot on the walls. And I went down there with somebody one time who said to me, look, we used to be able to project our auras. And when we projected our auras, we could use that as light, and that's the ambient light that was used to do all these carvings, and that's why there's no soot on these ceilings. And that made sense to me. Whether it's what was used in the crypts or not, it made sense to me about being able to project our auras and that's like a technology that we've lost. That wouldn't surprise me at all. There was something deep that kind of resonated with me for that.
Well, it was either that or bioluminescent algae or something powered with a Baghdad battery, so I'm not really sure. By the way, down there in the crypt is where the big lotus lamps are that you – there's only like two pictures on the internet of these things. And largely it's because most of the tourists that go take a small digital camera with them and they forget to bring a wide-angle lens. And just as Hallie said, you can only stand back about 3 feet from the wall.
Yeah.
So you can't get a shot of it if you don't have a wide-angle lens. And, of course, I thought ahead, and I took a wide-angle lens with me, so I have my own pictures of those hieroglyphs.
Yeah, and we have some really cool shots of that whole area because we've been down there, you know, like a dozen times by now. But it is really freaky-deaky because when you see these lotus lamps, as you're calling them, I mean, it's like, really, they're supposed to look exactly like incandescent lights, but it's a total coincidence, and really they're supposed to look like spots and, you know, follow spots, and that's a total coincidence. And it's just, I know that it doesn't make any sense, but it just is so remarkable when you look at these things. And it just looks power cords and lights.
Yeah, then you follow the power cords and they go back to batteries, and you see the positive and negative poles, and then you see cords going from battery to battery to battery, and some are red and some are blue. Yeah, they're still colored, red and blue. And you're going, okay, look, I'm an engineer, and I understand what I see here on the wall, and that's not what I'm hearing from the official version.
Well, our guide, who I call Shacky in the book, so to protect his privacy, I'll call him Shacky this evening. Shacky is, you know, he's just as woo-woo as the rest of us. And so he gets down there and he starts talking about aliens, and he starts talking about, you know, like there are these monkeys holding these knives, and they're kind of threatening looking. And you're like, hey, what's that? And he'll say, you know, oh, they're teaching. And it's like he's explaining that this is basically, this technology is being passed on to us. And it's quite fascinating. So that's one of the reasons that we deal with Quest, is they know everybody in the spiritual travel business, and their guides are very well versed in the off-the-beaten-path truth of things, as opposed to, as you just said, you know, whatever they're told to say. So we always get the, you know, the real deal, and that makes a big difference, because the people that, you know, the people that are guiding us are the same people that are guiding Graham Hancock and Robert Duvall and John Anthony West and Robert Schock, and, you know, and they're going up against, you know, Zahi Hawass and against the Egyptian Antiquities Department, who basically are saying things like, you know, no, that's just wind erosion on the Sphinx. And Robert Schock is going, I'm a geologist, it's water erosion, you can tell it's water erosion. And, you know, and then that becomes their life's work. So we're very lucky because the people that were with in Egypt understand so much more than, you know, just what meets the eye, and they don't just believe what the administration tells them to believe.
Yep. And by the way, if you hang around with Hallie very long, you're going to meet them. You know, the likes of we had dinner with John Anthony West one night, and only one night. I wish I could have spent more time there, but we were on a schedule. We just got back from China, and it was a business/pleasure trip that we were just, overdosing from, and we didn't get to spend much time with him. But what a great explorer he is. Unbelievable.
Absolutely, yes. He's the man. Yeah, in case anybody hasn't heard of him, he wrote the Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, which is like probably the first seminal spiritual guide to the keys of ancient Egypt as seen through the eyes of all of us woo-woo people. That's what I call it in the book, is the woo-woos. That's my phrase for it. So anyway.
And by the way, just so our listeners know, the other Earth explorers out there that didn't go on this cruise with us, this trip, Hallie and Greg and I and the group met just before the Twitter revolt. You could feel it humming in the city. We left days before it happened. And a couple of my associates, I think Diane from Michigan and some others, actually went after us with another group. I think it was William Henry's group, and they were in the middle of it. And so she's sitting down on the curb, and you know Diane, I mean, she serves biscuits to the occupiers, so she's all over this stuff. So she's down there talking to them and, listening to what their positions are and interviewing them, and she had a wonderful time. So did the whole group, even though that entire quote-unquote revolt went on. It was just basically a massive Egyptian sit-in that caused Mubarak to leave the country. Rah, rah. So that was...
Greg, we were there in November, just like, 2 months ago. And
right.
Greg was in Tahrir Square the day before the election. And he had a great time. He got a, I've been to Tahrir Square t-shirt. Of course, it said that in Arabic. And he was, a guy befriended him and escorted him around, and an Egyptian journalist interviewed him and asked his opinions, and he was there right in the middle of everything. And, there's definitely, an unfortunate element to what's been going on in Tahrir Square, in that the occupiers have not been allowed to just be there peacefully. But for the most part, there has been a really powerful, positive movement. And when you talk to the young people in Egypt, the people who are in their 20s and their 30s, they are so excited, and people are smiling and happy. And when you ask them about the revolution, they are thrilled that it's going on, and they are just so grateful. And, we didn't feel, as tourists being there, in November, as a group, I mean, we had 30 people with us, and it was fine. Everyone had an amazing time. And, the news media is so bad. We were there for a week after the trip ended and left, I think we left the night before the election. And I'm on the phone with my dad, who, he's read all my stuff. He's been with me to Egypt. He gets what's going on. And he's saying to me, "Don't you need to get out?" And Greg said to him on the phone one day, he was like, "It's not the fall of Saigon, but that's how the news media was portraying it back home." My dad's in Texas going, the airport's going to be closed any day now. And I'm on the Giza Plateau going, hey, we're going to the Mina House, the five-star hotel tonight, because it's Greg's birthday and Mohammed gifted Greg with a suite. Yay! And we're having this five-star incredible experience, and I'm getting a massage, and it's lovely. And you don't know Tahrir Square exists, just like, unfortunately, if you're six blocks outside of, the Occupy protests in the middle of Manhattan, you don't know that they exist.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what I really see as disingenuous about our press here, is we hear about the factions, what do we call them, Islamists, that are taking over the government. Hello, most people over there are Muslim, you know. So what do you mean Islamists taking over the government as opposed to what? Quakers? No?
Yeah, that's a really good point. There is a lot of fear around this revolution. But when you're on the ground, when you're in Egypt, especially when you're outside of central Cairo, and especially when you're outside of Cairo, period, it's literally not a factor in anyone's daily life. People are, you know, they're farming, they're waiting tables, they're going to work, they're living their lives. And even despite the fact that this revolution is, I believe, one of the most pivotal ones, it's the one that started the snowball of all these other revolutions in the Middle East. It is just, it's been done about as peacefully as it could be, given what's happened. And now I'm, you know, the concern is, will the military give up power? Will the military go? Or, you know, have they now decided that they're going to get entrenched and they want to stick around for a while? And, you know, we have yet to see what happens. But the elections are June and our next trip is December. And I'm sure we aren't going to have any problems. You know, Mohammed has always orchestrated things so beautifully for us. But, I mean, even now when we were there, just, you know, the trip ended just 5 days before the elections. And it was perfect. And everyone had an amazing time. And the message that I want to get out to everybody is go to Egypt. It's safe. And for the most part, it's kind of empty right now. So go now because it'll, you know, it's never going to be like that again in your lifetime. So.
Yeah. How much is the tourist business, you know, I hate to use the word down, but what is the percentage of tourists that are there now compared to, say, 2 years ago?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the estimate ranges from, it's off by between 50 and 80%. Now, when we were in places like Luxor Temple or whatever, we found it fairly crowded when we were there during the day. Karnak Temple is fairly crowded. Now, we're going off and we're doing our private things and we're getting our alone time anyway. So I didn't really sense that. It wasn't like, oh, we're the only people there. It's like we have a private visit everywhere. We had to pay for the private visit because otherwise we were going to be right in the middle of the tourist crowds like normal. But I know that I would say American tourism to Egypt is off by 80 or even 90%. And then in Europe and in Asia, those people are reacting differently to this. Maybe tourism is down by, you know, 30 to 50%, but a lot of people are still going. And so there are still crowds, even if they're smaller crowds. But some of the, you know, some of the experiences that people would have there, you know, like if you were just a regular tourist and you just wanted to get a good picture, your chances are better than they are ever going to be again.
Now, a couple of my listeners have texted me, and they're asking me if the Egyptian government still has its original stranglehold on all of the ancient sites. Are they still government controlled? Is Zawahiri still the iron-fisted controller over all these sites?
Absolutely. And another thing, something that happened a couple of years ago was there was this edict that came down from the Department of Antiquities that said you are not allowed to meditate in the temples. And meditation turned out to mean, like, you couldn't even, if you're with a group, you couldn't even close your eyes. Now, if you're there as a onesie or a twosie or whatever, that's fine. But if you go as a group, as a spiritual group, they are going to mess with you. I was in tears one time at Philae Temple, the Temple of Isis at Philae, because the guards were just interfering with our group's ability to meditate and tone. And toning is considered meditation. So if you're oming in the middle of a temple, which the sound is always so amazing that, of course, that's what we want to do, you're not allowed to do that. You can get around that by two ways. One is you can, if you're by yourself, if you go on your own, just bribe the guard. And if you go with a group, we go with a private visit, at which point we can do whatever we want and they leave us alone, which is very important. So I would say that, you know, yes, the answer is the government is in charge of the ancient sites, and the guards still have their jobs, and their jobs haven't changed. This is, you know, the Department of Antiquities rules are still in place.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make sure, because one of the things that we'd heard on the news or this particular listener that just texted me was when, you know, everything got out of control last November or December, whenever it fell, sort of, is there was some looting at the Egyptian Museum, and they were afraid that, you know, everything had been packed off by tourists. And I assured them that that probably was not the case. That, you know, Zawi was not taken out in the middle of the desert and released. He still was in control because I'm still here.
Well, Zawi isn't in position anymore as in that particular post, but he is still very active in the Department of Antiquities. But they did not loot the Egyptian Museum to any extent where it would be, stuff would be noticeable by a visitor. I mean, my understanding is they only show 3% of their archived collection at any one time.
Wow.
So that's a tiny little number in comparison to what they've got. That's a huge discrepancy. So they have plenty of stuff. When we were there this last November, so this is different, Brooks, from the trip that you and I were on together, they actually have, they're remodeling parts of the Egyptian Museum. It's going to be more like exit through the gift shop going forward. So they're upgrading it. And the museum over the years that I've been going, so, you know, 12, 13 years, has really improved, and it's beautiful. And the day that we were there, we're one block from Tahrir Square. I mean, the museum is literally like around the corner from the heart of everything. And it was, you know, it was quiet and peaceful. And we had two people who went over to Tahrir Square, and they were right in the throng because there were thousands of people gathered, and they were taking pictures and shooting video, and then they came back. So I just feel like, you know, there was a little bit of looting at the beginning, but it's I understand the stuff was returned, and in any case, there's no way that anybody would even notice if, you know, they could lose a quarter of the stuff in the museum. What they are doing is they're building a new Egyptian museum on the Giza Plateau, about 15 minutes from where we stay in at the pyramids. And so that new museum is going to be open along with the main Cairo Museum so that they can display more of their stuff. And I've seen, I saw a giant statue of Ramses, like a colossus of Ramses, being trucked in and being raised in the desert, because that's spot where they're starting to build the Egyptian Museum. It's supposed to be done at the end of 2012. I don't know if they'll get it. It might be done at the end of 2013, but it's getting there.
Oh, very cool. Well, they may be competing with the Maya, you know, because all the tourists are going to be down in the Yucatan on 2012. That's where I'm going to be in December of 2012, down at Chichen Itza.
Well, we've got another Egypt trip coming. We're planning on being in Egypt on 12-12-12 and also on 12-21. We will be doing, the last day of our trip is going to be at the Red Pyramid and the Bent Pyramid. And one of the reasons we're doing the Red and Bent Pyramid is we actually have more ability to move there freely, even on a day like, you know, 12-21. So we're going to be taking our group there. And we've, you know, so I think if you anchor Chichen Itza and we anchor the Giza Plateau, I think, you know, things will go well.
I was just going to say, we have it all covered. I mean, if anything happens anywhere on the ends of the earth, you or I are going to be there.
Yes, absolutely.
Then we got to get together and write another book together, and we'll have it all.
No problem. That's perfectly fine. I'd love to collaborate with you.
So
do you want a little reading from the book?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. So this is a chapter in the Valley of the Kings. I'm not going to read it. The book is basically like, it's my spiritual awakening in Egypt. It's the journey to get to that spiritual awakening. It's all these stories of my own experiences in Egypt. I talk about the Valley of the Kings, but you know, I'm going to just do this for a few minutes. So this is a very personal story that I'm going to be sharing with you about my panic attack in the shoom. So one thing that I want to mention beforehand is that we refer to Shaki, our guide, as the magician, and you'll see at the beginning of the story why this is. After breakfast, we enter the Valley of the Kings, home to many tombs of Egyptian pharaohs. On our earliest trip, we see Seti I's tomb, full of amazing color. Then we enter the tomb of Ramses II. Shaki wants us to be able to meditate inside, so he simply kicks out all the other tourists. He bribes the guard, of course, and he tells the waiting guides that the tomb is closed for 20 minutes due to some concern about air quality. Then he starts shouting into the long mouth of the tomb, "Out! Out! Close! The tomb's closed!" His voice, reverberating and amplified, carries deep into the tomb's main chamber. Then, when the tourists don't move fast enough, Shaki reaches along the tunnel wall and shuts off all the lights for a few seconds. When they go back on, the people scatter like roaches scuttling out to avoid fumigation. Not really fair, but terrific for our group. I vow to try to be less selfish in my next lifetime, presuming I have one. After the magician clears the tomb, he rushes us all in, past the glorious painted walls and down into the tomb. We arrange ourselves around the black granite sarcophagus. You can tell what Ramses thought of himself by its sheer size. Designed to hold graduated mummy cases, think Russian stacking dolls lying on their backs, it still doesn't explain the vast mass of rock Ramses wanted to be in. But I'm sure from what we see of his logic elsewhere, logic was not his from his ego elsewhere, I'm sure logic was not his gating factor. You've got to make a pretty big statement in life for a corporation to decide thousands of years later to name a condom after you. Once we're seated, he yells up to the guard to shut off all the lights again. We sit there in the pitch black, oming and breathing for about 10 minutes. Oh, it's kind of fabulous, as long as I don't open my eyes. But when I do, I realize it's equally dark no matter which position my eyelids are in. I'm new to meditation, and my mind tends to drift, which I understand is fairly typical of the Western brain. Deep breath in, deep breath out. Deep breath in, deep breath out. Wonder what we're having for lunch. What was the name of that god again? Oh no, I'm not thinking. I'm not meditating. I'm thinking again. Deep breath in, deep breath out, etc. In the middle of this ping-pong process that I pass off as a meditation practice, I suddenly remember the terrifying end of a movie I saw when I was a child. My dad and I would curl up together almost every weekend to watch the old movies he grew up on. This film was called Land of the Pharaohs, and it starred a young and fabulously glamorous Joan Collins as a real bitch kitty of a queen named Nellifer. Surely some studio head's idea of a ridiculous Egyptian glam name that would appeal to a 1950s audience. Nellifer plots to take over the kingdom by killing her husband and succeeds. She's about to triumphantly savor the victor's spoils as soon as she finishes this pesky burial procession and Pharaoh is interred in his tomb. Nellifer leaves the long funerary line of priests and slaves inside, and gives the order for the tomb to be sealed forever. The priests hit the stones, the doors grind closed, and the sand starts to pour in. Nellifer realizes she's been tricked and is trapped inside, and the head priest tells her this is the price for her treachery. As I recall, she asks him if he, too, is not afraid to die, but he points out that all these other men happily give their lives to go with their beloved pharaoh to the afterlife, whereas evil Nellifer is freaking out and trying desperately to get out. The men stand there implacable, stoic, and she runs around screaming to all the sealed exits, tearing at her bosom while the sand piles higher and higher. Roll credits. In the middle of my meditation, which now sounds more like shallow panting breath in, shallow panting breath out, shallow panting breath in, I'm thinking about the scene and the tomb and the black that just goes on forever. I open my eyes to see nothing. I fight down my panicky feelings, trapped inside this tomb, trapped for all eternity, not being me, not being anything anymore. I'm scared, angry, and I have this tremendous, petulant child's voice inside my head screaming, not fair, not fair. I know Ramsay's sarcophagus is right there near me, and I want to reach out to touch it. It's solid and cool, and I hope this will help. So I stand up in the middle of the group, but then I realize I can't see to reach it because it is that black. Is this what eternity will be like? Standing stock still in the middle of a room trying not to trip over anyone? Oh, no, wait. That's if I'm still me, but I won't be. I will be like the immobile stone itself, and Hallie will be gone forever. Not fair! Not fair! I am so panicked, I want to scream, and this meditation, which is about 10 minutes long, feels like freaking eternity. I suck in a deep, shuddering breath, and some of the electric tension goes out of my limbs. I have to calm myself to reason with whatever rational bits I can command. If I'm going to spend all eternity as not me, it will at least be peaceful. There's a tranquility in the tomb of Ramses and a coolness. I slow my breathing down until the panting, wet dog sensation is gone. I've almost gotten a handle on it when the lights come on again and it's time to head out. I walk up the long ramp to the surface slowly, breathing evenly, and say nothing to anyone of the incident. Greg and Lyra smile at me as they pass, chattering about the drawings on a tomb wall. Judith touches my hand as she walks by, but she's in conversation with Vivian about her experience in the mosque, and neither notices my discomfort. No one can help me. Not really. This is my most private fear, and I am too ashamed to speak of it. When the conversation on the ship turns to our experiences in Ramsay's tomb, I laugh along with the rest as Greg mimics Shaki. The tomb's closed! Everybody out! So to find out what happened to me and why I've never had a panic attack since, you have to read the book.
That's right. You have to read the book. Well, we're right at the top of the hour. Holly's going to hang around with us till the next hour. I'm going to take about a quick four-minute break here while we listen to some Civil Twilight. You will hang around, won't you?
Of course. I'm here for you, Brooks. Happy to be here.
All right. Well, we're going to open up the phone lines in the next hour, so just stand by your speed dial button. The number is 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-413-6472. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this.
Oh, escape.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Third hour. That was Civil Twilight, Letters from the Sky. You know, I just want to let you know that one of my good friends, Hans Mittendorf, is a writer, designer of soundscapes. You're hearing it in the background right now. Sometimes when you're meditating, having some soundscape music in the background can allow you to travel a little bit better, safely on your journey out and back. If you're interested in this kind of ambient music to put in the background during these moments, I encourage you to go to xsquaredradio.com. Click on Hans Mittendorf's artwork. You'll see it in the affiliates section. It's a beautiful red composition. It will take you to his Amazon page and you can select his soundscape music. I find it fascinating. I like things that are arrhythmic and artistic for myself. Stuff that's very rhythmic like dance music, I promise, it puts me right to sleep. I can't even drive to it. It's dangerous. I can drive to this stuff all night long and really, really let my mind go. Also, as you're making your plans for the next year, don't forget Maya 2012 in Chichen Itza. It's a good place to be. We want you to be there with us, Greg Braden. And don't forget Sting and Carlos Santana are going to be at the same venue during the same period of time, December 13th through the 22nd. I promise I'll have you home for Christmas. If you don't have a passport and you're not ready to make an international trip to the Yucatan, you can join me at the Pythagoras Conference just north of Louisville in the beautiful resort casino in southern Indiana. The Pythagoras Conference, if you click on the blue banner at X Squared Radio, you can get $100 off. Very affordable. 50 of some of the top world speakers and presenters. Royalty is going to be there. You have a chance to attend without flying. That's right. 73% of the population lives within an 8-hour drive of this location. You don't have to fly to L.A. You don't have to fly to Shasta or to San Francisco and drive for several hours to get there. You can land close and you can attend, and it's affordable. Southwest flies into Louisville. So there you go. You have it all right at your fingertips. The Pythagoras Conference. Click on the blue banner at X Squared Radio, and I will see you there in October. If you really want to have an eye-opener, and by the way, we need some of you to go on the Spirit Quest Tour with Hallie and her husband Greg. We'll need you in Egypt at about the same time, December 21st, 2012. And you can hold the other end of the earth in balance. And we'll tell you how to get a hold of that. That's Spirit Quest Tours with Hallie and Greg. So, welcome back to the program, Hallie. I know he's got you muted because I think you were hollering at the dog, so he's going to bring you on in a second.
Hello?
Yeah. Okay, now you're there. One of the things that happens to you when you go on these trips, I mean, it's nice to get on a big cruise ship, although I wouldn't want to be going with this one captain that just recently ran his boat aground. But it's even better to be on, you know, a dahabeya, because this is really the ancient classic way that royalty went up and down the Nile. And the nice thing about it is these are not small boats, but they're smaller ships, and they can stop along the way. There's no, okay, we're going to Luxor, and everybody's going to get out at one time, and we're like a big, massive, you know, bunch of Dutch people running through every shop in the place on a strict schedule because we don't want to miss the departure. You guys are in charge. You got 8 days, and you can stop and put your fingers and bare feet into the soil of an ancient island in the middle of the river where, you know, society hasn't changed for 2,000 years. There are things that you can do with the Spirit Quest Tour that you just cannot do any other way. And you get to meet.
Yeah, that's one of the things I talk about in the book is getting to stop by the side of the Nile and getting to do. I mean, we've done all kinds of things. We had an impromptu soccer game one time, which was, you know, football, Egyptians versus the Australians. And it was terrific. It was, you know, and it would never have happened before. And some of the people on the Egyptian side for the impromptu soccer game had never met a white person before. Because it's just, you know, you're out in a village in at the side of the Nile, and they've just never left it.
Well, that's the kind of experience that you have. So it is a tour, but it isn't tourist. And what happens, and what I found so fascinating in Hallie's book, because as I was reading it, I felt like, hey, I was there. I went through that. I did that. That was cool. You know, you can read the book and you can get a very, very different perspective than the average, you know, picture-snapping Hawaiian shirt-wearing tourist. Or you can experience it. You can be inspired by the book, which I hope is the plan, and then you can join a 30- or 40-person group, and you can go for yourself and have these experiences and overcome all your fears of travel. And tight places and ancient places and smelly places all at the same time.
Yeah, you know, Greg is really good at TFT, thought field therapy. And so he'll say, like, you know, who's claustrophobic? And in a group of, you know, 30 people, like half of the group will raise their hand. And he'll take them and all together outside of the, like outside of the Great Pyramid, for example, and he'll show them the tapping algorithm that you use in thought field therapy for claustrophobia. And then every single one of those people will do it, which takes about 2 minutes, and then they will all go right into the Great Pyramid, even if 5 seconds earlier they were terrified of small enclosed spaces. It's quite fascinating. So, yeah, we're trying to help you get over a lot of these fears while you're on the trip.
Yeah, and also Greg is, you know, he isn't fluent in a lot of languages, but he's able to teach you, you know, the average Arabic. Put a dalabe on me, which is the man's gown that they wear. And it was of such high quality. You know, it wasn't just a rag. This was a really well-done garment. And one of the things the men do, this may be all they wear. I mean, they wear sandals. They wear some shorts underneath it possibly. But they're not showing their drawers. They're kind of like a Scotsman, you know. We're not going to show you what's under the kilt. But one of the things they do is they'll reach forward and they'll grab the shirt sleeve and peel back the cuff to notice the stitching. And they'll decide right there whether you're wearing a high-quality dalabeya or a rag. And fortunately for me, Greg is a little bit smaller than I am, but he's about the same height. And at the time, I was in great athletic shape. And I fit into this nicely. It didn't look like a local by the least, although I don't have blonde hair and blue eyes like Greg does. And he taught me a little bit of Arabic, Because one of the things that people do on the side of the road or side of the small street as you're going down the shop is they'll notice that you're wearing a dalabaya. They'll run up, they'll grab the seat, and they'll go, "Hey, Saidi," which means you're a city boy, right? Well, I'm not really. I'm a country boy. So that's aomda. Aomda means country boy. So I would say aomda, and then I would say oa Saidi, which means Greg's the city boy. And they just got the biggest kick out of that.
That's hilarious. Well, the now the Saidi actually, I believe, means that you're from southern Egypt.
Right.
As opposed to from, you know, from Cairo. So you could be from the city of Luxor, but it means you're from the south. So in a way, they were sort of calling you a country boy, but not Omda. And Greg loves that they talk to him. And, you know, you're right, he's not fluent in Arabic, but he will tell you that he can curse with the best of them in Arabic. All the temple guards over the years have taught him to curse. So I could say terrible things to you, all your listeners right now in Arabic, because, of course, I've heard these absolutely awful words. And there's this one place we go to called the Alley of the Tent Makers, which is behind the Khan El Khalili Market. And the Khan El Khalili is a 1,000-year-old souk. So it's a 1,000-year-old market, and it's absolutely amazing to go. And then the Alley of the Tent Makers is where all of the sales for the dahabeyas and all of the sales for and all of the tents for the big parties that they have out in the desert, that's where those are all made. And they've been made in the Alley of the Tent Makers for, again, you know, like 1,000 years. And we go in there, and I actually hadn't been in about a year, and I went down to my favorite place to buy scarves, you know, these gorgeous, like, Pashmina-style scarves for $5 or $4 or something. And so I'm down there with some of the people in my group, and the guy says, "Hey, I remember you." And I'm thinking, yeah, you know, you say that to everybody. And he goes, "No, I remember you." And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, no, your husband. Your husband has the bad mouth. And he really did, because he remembers Greg calling him a very bad name, because the guy wouldn't come down far enough in price for one of the people in our group. And so Greg called him a bad word in Arabic anyway. And the guy remembered, and it's so funny. And now we go back every year, and he teases me about that.
That is so funny. I knew this woman. She's a translator. She was raised in Germany, and then she moved to Israel, and she learned Hebrew. And she became a business document translator between Hebrew and German, which I guess pays pretty well. But she also can speak Moroccan. And let me tell you, you don't even have to know the words to realize that when someone says a Moroccan curse, the worms are going to be crawling out of your nostrils any moment. It's really amazing. Did we lose Holly? I heard a click. It sounds pretty silent. Well, maybe BBS is going to try and get her back here really quickly, because something happened. I know that BBS Radio, they told me today that for 12 days somebody has been targeting the station, and we hope that that has not happened tonight. If it has, we will recover rather quickly. So the studio is now trying to get Hallie back. I know there's no storms in Southern California, so she should be okay. As soon as we get her back, we'll finish the interview. One of the things that is happening in the news as we move forward, as you realize, the Republican nomination was the greatest show on earth, it seems. It's a lot more entertaining than the Democrat one 4 years ago, simply because the candidates are more animated and they're more stratified. You have the Liberty line of Ron Paul here at this program. And you have the other three candidates, which are really, you know, the flavor of the week, just as Ron Paul says. You have one that is labeled as a Massachusetts moderate, and the other is a Washington insider. And then you have the junkyard dog of Rick Santorum. And I have heard many people say of late that they wish they could find a candidate that was a blend of all four of them. You know, tall and handsome like Mitt Romney, more mainstream religious and right-wing like Rick Santorum, able to handle his own in a fight or in a debate like Newt Gingrich, and strictly libertarian and constitutional like Ron Paul. Can't hear me, can't hear her. Okay, well, that's interesting. Let's see if I'm getting anything going here. Hold on a second. Let me check my sound. Sometimes we get a click. No, my sound is fine.
Bear with us, ladies and gentlemen. We're trying to figure this out.
Studio. So let me see. Let me just write him real quick. I heard a click, and then there was none. So I guess the studio is trying to get her back. They can't hear me. You can hear me because you're listening to the archive. All right, we're going to try and reconnect. All right, let's try that. Can you hear me now? I'm live. Okay, that's good. All right, we'll try to get Hallie back in just a second, and we'll finish the interview. Interesting stuff going on in the news, though. Let's see if I can turn this up a little bit. All right, I will try that. Increase my volume. There we are. More. Okay, there we are. And hopefully I'm not, you know, peeking out my recorder. Okay, let me go in here to tools, options. I hate to take you people all through this, but you know how live radio is. Okay, we'll raise that up a little bit. How's that? There we go. Okay, we can work with that. Excellent. All right, we'll get Hallie back on in just a second, and we will take off. Just cool stuff happening in the news. I just urge you to participate. That's the thing. Don't say, well, my guy's not winning, so I'm not going to vote. No, please go and vote. Even if you don't vote for president, you can't make your mind up. Pull either none of the above or anybody but who's in office for Congress, and then everything will be okay. I think that one- or two-time congressmen are fine, but two-time senators, got to go. Got to go. Go. Clean it up. Let's clean the house. All right, we're echoing a little bit, but we'll get Hallie back with us. Hallie, how are you?
I'm good. Hi, Brooke. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. It happens on live radio. So we were talking about a change that occurs to people when they take this spiritual tour and they experience these things. It's not like a tourist trip, like, oh, gee, that was fun. I want to show you my picture album. The change that occurs, actually, is noticed by people that have known these people their whole lives. Absolutely. They come back and they say, Susan, you've changed.
Yep. There's something about being in Egypt that, I mean, I feel like, you know, two-thirds of my job is just getting somebody there. Because, you know, I mean, when I was there, I didn't have somebody facilitating for me the way that Greg facilitates for people, or the way that I facilitate for people, or the way that you would, you know, with you leading a trip. It's just a very, you know, I just think getting there is just so important. And one of the reasons that I wrote Red Goddess Rising was to help kind of jumpstart people along their own journey, because there are people who will never go to Egypt. There are people who will never take that trip. And I wanted them to experience through my eyes some of the stuff that I have experienced. Now, I've had people writing to us for, you know, since we started leading these trips, who would say, you know, my life is so different. I mean, we've had people have these enormous spiritual healings. As you were talking before about the Eat, Pray, Love trip to Bali. That's another one. People have these enormous healings. You know, people who are widowed, who are releasing their anger towards or their fear of something. And they just write to me afterwards, and they're like, oh, my God, it just changed everything for me. So, yeah, huge shifts for people. But for a lot of people, they can't take those trips. And so I hope that in a year or so that I'll be getting letters from people saying, you know, your book awakened this part of me that I didn't know that I had, and that caused me to X. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that some of the magic that happens while you're there is going to happen to people when they read Red Goddess Rising. That's what I hope.
Well, I think that's what people are going to experience, because that's what I remember when I read the book. When I get a few pages into the book, this familiar kind of sound, this familiar feeling comes back. It's one that I feel when I'm there at Giza. And the interesting thing that happens during this, I'm going to call it a you could call it a spiritual awakening, but it's really a mighty change of heart. People go through this connection between themselves and ancient Egypt. I don't know why it is, but they do. And one of the things that they realize is that the Egypt that's there now is not the Egypt they're connecting with. It's something before that, something even more mysterious and more universal than that. And by the way, okay, I see, okay. I'm just looking at some technical notes coming in from the studio. So I don't know if you heard what I just said.
I did not, but I was going to go with it anyway. So try me again.
All right. I was going to say, when I read the book, this familiar feeling came back to me when I was in Egypt, and this connectedness that seems to occur when you're in Egypt. And it doesn't, I know it sounds strange to people who've never been there, but in reading the book, you will kind of have a feeling of familiarity about it. Maybe not all the sights and sounds and everything that Hallie's describing, but this connectedness to ancient Earth. And I hesitate to use the term ancient Egypt, because the Egypt that's there now isn't the Egypt that you connect to. It's something much older. And I'm going to call it much more galactic than what you're connecting to there.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And I feel like, you know, whether people believe in past lives or not, whether people are tapped into their past lives or not, those connections exist no matter what your belief system is in this current lifetime. And so I think for a lot of people, they just resonate with Egypt, or they don't. I mean, I'm one of those people that, you know, once I got there, I really thought back and was like, oh, yeah, I was really into the Egyptian gods when I was like 5 and 6 years old. But by the time I was 8 or 9, I was into something else, and I didn't pay any attention to them ever again. But, like, why was I attracted to the Egyptian gods when I was a little kid? And then after I'd had, you know, not just the spiritual awakening in Egypt, but also the stuff that led up to it, I was remembering past lives that I had spent in Egypt. And I was shocked, because I didn't believe in that stuff. That part, you know, I talk about that in the book a lot, is because I'm, you know, as a person, I'm very skeptical. I'm very logical. I really like things to be shown to me as opposed to just told to me. So for me to go through the experiences that I went through as an atheist, as somebody who really had no real spiritual background, it was very powerful. And again, I feel like when people read the book, they're going to get that too, no matter what their belief system is, because that's just what's there and that's what's available for the taking.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's what, you know, whether you're walking up down the alley of the tent makers or having tea outside of what we would call an old style general store, where you can buy a hubcap or a newspaper or an old lamp. come on, we did it. We sat in rocking chairs and we drank tea and we watched the locals walk by and we just had conversations on the street, you know, like locals. It was awesome.
Absolutely, absolutely. Hey, I don't want to forget to tell people about the website. So can I just give that information real quick?
It's required. You have to.
Oh, thank you. Well, the website to go to is my name, HallieEvelyn.com, and I'll spell that for you. But the reason that you want to go there is, one, there's a lot of information about Red Goddess Rising, but also if you sign up for the Red Goddess Rising community, you can download for free a bonus companion ebook. And the ebook has photos, gorgeous pictures of Egypt, and a quote from each chapter. So there's, I think there's 35 chapters, so there's 35 quotes and 35 beautiful pictures of Egypt, and it really brings Egypt to life. And it's absolutely beautiful, and all you do is you put, like, your name and your email address in, that's it, and it's, like, 2 seconds, and then you get this gorgeous ebook, and you can download it and, you know, share it with your friends if you like. So that's on HallieEvelyn.com, and Hallie is spelled Hallie like Barry. H-A-L-L-E, and then Evelyn is E-A-V like Victor, E-L-Y-N, like Nancy. So it's HallieEvelyn.com, and you can download the free companion photo ebook.
There you go. That's total value. And all you have to do is go register. So I would highly recommend doing it. And while you're at it, click on the Red Goddess Rising Amazon link at xsquaredradio.com and go purchase the book. Well spent $15, and it'll get right out to you. One of the things that some people ask me from time to time is what are the plans for Egypt now that, you know, Mubarak is out and, you know, we've been sending billions of dollars to Egypt for what? I have no idea. But, you know, are they going to start getting drinking water out to the areas like out there to Abu Ghraib? You know, when you drive down that road along one of the tributaries, it's horrible. I remember Mohammed and I sat down and we talked about building a commercial canal cleaning barge or some kind of equipment that would go down the tributary or down the canal there and clean out all the bottles and tires and trash and everything out of this and clean up those canals so that people can draw clean drinking water or cleaner drinking water from the Nile spillways. Is anything being done like that now that are there plans for that now that Egypt has changed hands?
I haven't heard of anything. I mean, I wish. Honestly, Egypt is still a third world country when it comes to the modern side of it. And I talk about that a lot in Red Goddess Rising, my frustration with, like, these giant garbage piles. I mean, there are many places where there is just no what we would consider modern sanitation. Like you take a horse out onto the Giza Plateau and you go horseback riding out in the at the pyramids or at the Sphinx, and it's beautiful. But as you ride your horse from Stable Row on the, you know, behind the Sphinx down onto the sand, you pass these enormous garbage piles, and they're covered in starving dogs and goats, and it's just sad, and it makes me very upset. And I want to start a recycling program in Egypt, and I want the Afandina to get converted to, as we were talking the other day, electric or biodiesel, so that we don't have to have the diesel tug anymore. And you know, I know that somebody is going to make a lot of money revolutionizing that part of Egypt. Forget the government. The government's going to, you know, that revolution is on its way. But getting the garbage and the sanitation services in Egypt and in many other third world countries. I mean, I heard a couple of months ago that Saudi Arabia had brought in goats to clean up their garbage. Now, I don't think that's a recent thing. In fact, I have no idea what the current situation is in Saudi right now. But that kind of tells you, I mean, you know, Saudi Arabia is one of the richest countries in the world, and here they were trucking in goats for, for to eat the garbage. That's... I mean, it does work, but it's not a really an automated kind of a solution. So, yeah, the tributaries of the Nile, and especially in Cairo, there's a lot of old garbage. But once you get out onto the main parts of the Nile, you know, once you get into to Upper Egypt, which is Southern Egypt, you really don't see a lot of that. And there are regulations. They're cleaning things up. Like the cruise boats are not allowed to just dump their trash. They're not allowed to dump any of their waste in the Nile. And there was a time that they did not have that regulation. I mean, you know, hello, there was a time when we didn't have that regulation. So there have been changes. There are shifts that are coming slowly. And I hope that as things like capitalism move into Egypt at the beginning of this current century, that the first place that somebody is going to look is, hey, if we start a recycling program in Egypt, we could make bajillions of dollars. And hopefully they're going to do that. And they won't do it for altruistic purposes. They'll do it because they want to make money. But the upshot will be the same. The garbage piles and the plastic bottles will get taken out of the Nile. I hope. Well, my fingers are crossed.
There's some intention to put, you know, headwaters of money there to attract companies that do that really well, whether it's waste management or BFI or some of the many companies that do that in Europe pretty well. Hopefully it gets out there because it's very badly needed. And here we are in the 21st century, and we really haven't, you know, we haven't got people to move out of the cemetery yet. That's,
well, and I mean, that's because there's not enough room. I mean, they moved it. There were refugees that moved into the City of the Dead after the Six Days War. So this is back in the 60s in the war with Israel, which Egypt was pretty much fairly trounced in that 6 days. And so afterwards, it was like there were all these refugees pouring in, and they were like, we have no place to put them, and they're all right here, right now. Let's move them into the City of the Dead. But it's not like being in a cemetery anywhere in the United States. It's more like the closest would be like maybe a cemetery in New Orleans where there's a lot of mausoleums. But the traditions in Egypt, and I talk about this in Red Goddess Rising, the traditions in Egypt are, one, to revere the dead, two, to spend time with the dead in mourning, during like a long time, like 40 days, and then three, to be in close proximity with the dead, for, you know, like to have the family mausoleums or the family tombs. It's not a bad thing to, you know, to be there. And in the case of spending 40 days, there were, even in like, you know, the 12th century, which I think is what the tombs in the City of the Dead date back to, there Muslims would set up churches and schools inside of cemeteries because you had to do something while you were there for that 40 days doing the mourning. Their mosques and their schools and their kitchens and everything, I mean, it was like a working home. And so it's not quite as foreign to them to have moved into the cemetery and stayed as it would be for a Westerner. I mean, the Western mind can hardly get their head around the idea of that.
People living in a cemetery that has no running water and no sanitary services.
Yeah. I mean, but you saw Egypt. A lot of Egypt doesn't have the kind of sanitary services that we're used to. But you're right. There's no running water. There's no electricity. But the tombs themselves are underground. So it's like living inside of a big marble room, like a floor. The floor is marble. And then it's just, there's nothing in there. Or in some cases, there's a, you know, there's a tombstone sticking up and somebody's turned that into a shelf or, you know, or the side of a table. And so it's weird because when you're in the mausoleum itself, you don't really realize that it's a mausoleum. It just looks like somebody's house. Because we've actually been in there. We have these amazing pictures of, there was one carved tomb. It was done from marble, and it's basically a bed of roses. I don't know how else to explain it. It's a queen-size bed. It's covered in roses and lace, and the whole thing is done in marble. It was done by, I believe, a Venetian artist, and I want to say it was like one of King Farouk's mistresses. It was one of the kings of Egypt, and it was his mistress, and he absolutely adored her, and he couldn't bury her with his wives. So when she died, he had her buried in the City of the Dead, and he had this amazing carved marble bed made for her, and I've stood next to it. It's absolutely exquisite. It's like Michelangelo gorgeous, but it's in the middle of somebody's house now.
Wow.
Yeah,
well, the book's called Red Goddess Rising. The author is Hallie Evelyn, and the website.
And it turns out, Brooks, you can go to redgoddessrising.com. We just got that yesterday, and I totally forgot about it. So you can go to redgoddessrising.com to download that photo ebook as well.
Excellent, excellent. Redgoddessrising.com. Okay, I'll stick that link out there too when we do the archive. We upload it tonight, and it'll be an MP3 for everybody who wants to tell their friends that you heard this amazing interview tonight, and they can listen to it tomorrow while they're at work or any time in the next 100 years. X-Word Radio has been on the BBS Radio Network. We're going into our seventh year now, and you know, it's been a steady growth curve. I know that some of the big boys out there are pretty flat. Even though they got 695 radio stations, they're not growing very much. And if you look at our website growth compared to their website growth, it's, well, the difference is like between a slope and a street. So we're continuing to grow. And I think as far as webcast radio, we're still probably in the top 10 webcast radio programs in the country, and the other nine sort of change out because people try to see if they have what it takes. They do a lot of marketing and rise in this business, and then they figure out they don't have what it takes, and so they quit. So the other nine change out a lot, and we've stayed. So we're just like a mainstay, and it's because we meet tremendously interesting and exciting people like Hallie. We travel the world with them. They end up writing books, and we get them on the program, and we talk about our experiences. And it's really a lifelong journey. And I like our mutual friend John Riley. That's the way he says it. It's a journey. And once people get on the path, they start changing, and they start morphing into this new being. It's quite incredible.
Very well said, sir.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the program. I got about 8 minutes left in the program, and I got some victuals I have to take care of. So I very much appreciate you coming on the program. It is an absolute pleasure to speak to you at length about not only our common experience, but your incredible life-changing growth as a from a tourist to a spiritualist in these mysterious lands.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being on, and thank you again. It was just terrific. Thank you again so much, Brooks.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And sometime we'll have to have you on to talk about Eat, Pray, Love. It's really kind of a phenomenon. I mean, I watched the movie. It took me three times, but I finally made my way through the movie.
The book's a lot better, Brooks. The book's a lot better.
I reckon so. No, I think the tour is even better than the book, though.
Well, I have to say, when we first started doing the tour, I was like, no one is going to be able to go to Bali for 1 week and experience the kind of changes that Liz had in her book. But I got to tell you, in April, we're doing our fifth Eat, Pray, Love tour. If people are interested in it, they can go to spiritquesttours.com and check it out. But I've got testimonials that tell me that I was just wrong. I mean, we do themes from the book, and we take people to meet the people in the book from Bali, and we stay on the same street that Liz stayed at a much nicer hotel. And it's just an incredible experience for people. And that's what I want to do with Red Goddess Rising. I'm saying this out loud to all of your millions of listeners. I'm saying I want to do for Egypt what Eat, Pray, Love did for Bali.
There you go. There you go. That's it. We're going to do Red Goddess Rising tours.
Yeah, that's fine. We're already doing those.
All right.
Anyway,
excellent,
thanks.
Excellent.
This has really been fun. I so appreciate it. And this has been great. So have a good night. And thank you again.
All right. Thank you very much, Ali. We'll talk to you another time.
All right. Take care. Cheers.
Good night. All right, Earth Explorers, next month, February, is going to be exciting. A lot of things happening on the technology front. I hope that I am here for all the Sundays in February. We'll just try. Even if I have to do it from India, we'll see what we can do. It's a different time zone over there. It's kind of a time zone and a half. So here it is pushing 11 o'clock, and over there it's getting ready to be 9:30 in the morning. So it's a little bit different doing business this way, but we'll do our best to keep the program coming to you while we're doing this engineering work and getting the products ready for market. Also, don't forget my email address, bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com. If you have any questions about tonight's program or have any trouble with any of the archives, we have signed up close to 8,000 people in our newsletter, and I haven't done one in a while. So if I have any experienced newsletter writers out there, bloggers that would like to pick up my work for me in that respect, I would be interested. Write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. We are also playing with the idea of a cell phone app for X Squared Radio, a la bbsradio.com. If you're interested in that, it would be value added to you, where you can, in a moment of panic, where you don't have good information coming to you, you can hit that cell phone app, and you can get right into bbsradio.com anytime, 24 hours a day. And we may make it to where you can actually listen to the archives directly, just so you know. And the third thing is that BBS Radio is adding the feature of video. So we may be adding a video cam to at least a portion of the program. And that way, you can not only hear what's going on, but you can also see me here in the undisclosed location studio, wherever I may be. And I will announce generally what area I am at, but not the exact location, because some of the material that we talk about is highly controversial, and we simply don't want to be tracked down while we're talking about that stuff. We want to be able to be secure while we're doing that. And this message goes out to whoever has been hassling my buds down at BBS Radio. I have your number, so do it again and see what happens. I'll send my friend Steeleye after you. So if you're interested in the video, please write me, bagnew@x2-radio.com. If you're joining the program by Skype, you might be able to do it anyway, but we're going to be able to post this. We're going to have an app in the website. So at either x2radio.com or bbsradio.com, you can click the current program, which, of course, will be mine, and you'll be able to see the video. You'll be able to see yours truly. Sweating his way through a three-hour program as all these live mistakes happen, and we feel them as they come. So if you have any suggestions or a thumbs up, thumbs down, I'll post it on Facebook as well. You can like it. Don't forget to go to xsquaredradio.com and click the little like button. You know, we're up to, I don't know, a couple thousand. I would like to see like 2 million likes on there. Because if we can do that, we have a little bit of leverage with the big boys, and we can bring some monetization to the program and bring you even more excellent stuff. This is webcast radio at its worst, at its best. Sometimes Skype doesn't work very well, just like it's not working right now. But I will play my exit, and I know it's about 15 minutes till the hour. It gives a chance for our affiliates to fill in and for them to get the next program on. So I will play my exit, and we will see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.